Have you ever wanted to really dig into a specific book of the Bible, like maybe 1 Corinthians, and then you suddenly realize there are just a ton of English translations out there?
So
It could
many.
be kind of overwhelming, right?
Absolutely.
It's like, where do you even begin?
Well, in this deep dive,
Okay.
we're going to unpack some really interesting stuff
Okay.
that'll hopefully help you make sense of this whole world of Bible translations. They've been looking at
Yeah.
a lecture on 1 Corinthians
Okay.
by Dr. Gary Metters.
I know him, yeah.
Oh, you do?
He's great.
He's an
Yeah.
emeritus professor of Greek and New Testament.
Wow.
So he's been studying these things for
Oh,
decades.
yeah.
He brings a ton of knowledge to the table. And what we really want to do in this deep dive is
Yeah.
give you like a solid foundation
Okay.
for understanding
Right.
the different types of English Bible translations out there.
Because Dr. Metters really argues that this is the crucial first step to really studying a book like 1 Corinthians well.
I see.
So think of this as like we're giving you the tools to confidently approach different translations and to understand why they might present the same verses in slightly different ways without, feeling completely lost.
Makes sense.
So to kick things off, where does the story of translating the Bible even begin?
Well, to really understand these English versions,
Right.
we have to go back to the original languages
Yeah.
that the Bible was written in.
Okay.
So the Old Testament was primarily in Hebrew,
Right.
with some parts in Aramaic,
Okay.
which is a very closely related language.
That's like a sister language.
Yeah, kind of.
Okay.
And here's something interesting.
Bruh.
Even before the time of Jesus,
Wow.
there was a significant translation into Greek called the Septuagint.
Septuagint.
It's often referred to as LX.
LXX.
Now, this happened in Egypt between the 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE,
Okay.
and it became like the Greek Bible for a
Okay.
lot of Jewish people living outside of Israel,
I see.
and crucially for the early Christians. In
Yeah, okay.
fact, the writers of the New Testament themselves
Right.
often quote from this Greek translation.
It's pretty wild to think that early church's scriptures weren't even in the original Hebrew. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
And you mentioned the Dead Sea Scrolls. How do those fit into the picture for us?
So the Dead Sea Scrolls are super important.
Okay.
They date back to the 2nd to 1st centuries BCE,
BCE. Okay.
and they actually give us
Okay.
like much older Hebrew texts
Wow.
for almost the entire Old Testament.
So older than what we had before.
That's right. Now, the standard Hebrew Bible
Okay.
that scholars used for a long time was
Right.
actually a much later version from around the 9th century AD.
Hey,
So
hey.
the Dead Sea Scrolls are really valuable.
Right.
They give us a comparison point.
Yeah.
They show us how the Hebrew text was passed down
Okay.
over all those centuries.
Interesting. Okay, so we've got the Old Testament in Hebrew and Aramaic, then the Greek Septuagint, and these Dead Sea Scrolls giving us a window into earlier forms of Hebrew. What about the New Testament itself?
Well, the New Testament was primarily written in Greek.
Okay.
And get this,
Okay.
we have like a massive number of surviving Greek handwritten copies,
Wow.
around 5,200 of them.
5,200 handwritten copies.
Handwritten.
Wow.
And they date all the way from the 2nd to the 16th century.
Second to 16th century. That's a huge range.
It is, of course, all handwritten, right?
Yeah.
Before printing even existed.
Yeah, of course.
And it's helpful to kind of distinguish
Okay.
between complete Greek manuscripts,
Of the New Testament. And then what are called Greek lectionaries.
Lectionaries.
Yeah, these were like collections of specific scripture readings selected for use in church services.
Like a greatest hits.
Kinda. Yeah. So they're not complete Bibles, but they're super interesting because they show us which passages were like considered important and actively used in early Christian worship.
Oh, I see. So it tells us something about
Yeah.
what they focused on.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So 5,200 manuscripts. That sounds like a lot.
It is.
Were most of those from like the very early days of Christianity?
That's a good question.
Yeah,
Actually,
well,
only about 318 of them.
out of 5,200.
Yeah.
Wow.
Come from before the 9th century AD.
Oh, wow.
So there was a significant increase in the production of manuscripts starting in the 9th century.
Particularly within the Roman Catholic Church.
Okay.
As you know, scriptoriums grew.
So it became a bigger thing.
Right, exactly.
Got it.
Yeah, so those later manuscripts, they're still valuable.
Right.
But it's just important to remember that the number of really early copies is relatively small.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just so we're all on the same page, Dr. Metters mentioned the date conventions.
Okay.
BC, ECE, and PT.
Right.
Could you just quickly explain what those mean?
Of course.
Okay.
So BC stands for before Christ, and AD traditionally stands for Anno Domini.
Anno Domini.
Which means in the year of our Lord.
Okay.
Then you have BCE, which stands for before the Common Era.
Before Common Era.
And CE stands for Common Era.
For Common Era.
So essentially,
okay,
they refer to the same periods of time.
Got it.
BCE corresponds to BC.
Right.
And CE to AD.
Okay.
BCE, CE is more common academic writing now.
Okay.
But they both mean the same thing.
Got it.
Yeah.
So we have this deep history.
Right.
In the original languages.
Mm-hmm.
And then these early translations.
Yeah.
Dr. Metters also touched on some of the first translations.
Okay.
Into languages other than Greek.
Right, right.
So tell me about those.
So early on, the Bible was translated into other important languages of the time.
Okay.
And Latin was a key one.
Latin.
Yeah. You've probably heard of Jerome's Vulgate.
I have.
That was completed around 404 CE.
Okay.
And it became like the most significant Latin translation.
Got it.
It was commissioned in the late 4th century.
Okay.
And it was the dominant Bible in the Western Church for over 1,000 years.
That's a long time.
It is.
Okay.
Now, there were also early translations into Coptic.
Coptic.
Yeah, that was the language of Christian Egypt.
Interesting.
And other languages, too.
Right.
But a crucial point that Dr. Metters makes is that
for
centuries in the West, access to the Bible was largely limited to those who understood Latin.
Right. So if you didn't speak Latin, you were kind of out of luck.
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That really highlights this strong desire people had to have the Bible in languages that they could actually understand.
Absolutely.
Like their everyday language.
Yeah.
And that leads us to the rise of English Bibles, right?
Oh, it does.
And the name John Wycliffe.
Oh, yeah.
He's one of the first we encounter.
Yeah, he's a big one.
Okay, tell me about him.
So John Wycliffe lived in England in the late 14th century,
1329
to 1384.
Okay.
And he was a truly pivotal figure.
Okay.
Because he really aimed to translate the Bible into English,
right,
the language spoken by the common people.
Right.
But there was a problem.
Okay.
He faced some major opposition from the Roman Catholic Church, who preferred the control that the Latin Vulgate afforded.
So they wanted to keep it in Latin.
They did.
Okay.
But Wycliffe and his colleagues, they produced a very literal translation based on that Vulgate.
Mm.
This was a super controversial undertaking.
Okay.
And even after Wycliffe died, the church actually ordered his remains to be dug up and burned.
That's intense.
It is as a way of rejecting his work.
So they were really serious about this.
Very serious.
Wow. Yeah. That really emphasizes how much control over the scriptures was really at stake.
Totally.
Then we come to William Tyndale.
Oh, yes. William Tyndale.
He's often credited as a key figure in bringing the Bible into English directly from the original languages.
That's right.
Yeah.
So Tyndale's contribution was immense.
Oh.
In 1526, he printed his English translation of the New Testament. Now, unlike Wycliffe, Tyndale worked directly from those original Greek texts.
Wow.
But tragically, he was executed in 1536.
Wow.
Before he could finish translating the Old Testament.
So he didn't get to complete the whole thing.
Sadly, no.
Wow.
And, you know, Dr. Metters shared this really moving story about Bruce Metzger, who was a renowned Bible scholar.
Yeah.
And he received this urn.
An urn.
Yeah.
Wow.
Containing a burned copy of a Bible translation that he had worked on.
So someone had burned his translation?
They did. And Metzger's response was, at least they're burning the Bible and not the translators, which is a stark reminder, you know, of the real dangers that people faced throughout history.
Yeah, it puts it in perspective.
It does.
Wow.
Yeah.
So following Tyndale, we see a bunch of other English Bibles start to appear.
Right. No. Yeah. So after Tyndale's death, things kind of shifted politically and religiously.
Right.
And England became a center for Bible translation.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So we see the Coverdale Bible.
The Coverdale.
In 1535.
Okay.
The Great Bible.
Okay.
In 1539.
Okay.
The Geneva Bible.
Okay.
In 1560.
The Geneva Bible.
Yeah.
And what was that one known for?
So the Geneva Bible was the one that the pilgrims used.
Oh, the pilgrims.
When they came over to America.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then we have the Bishop's Bible.
Bishop's Bible.
In 1568.
Okay.
And all of these, they kind of laid the groundwork for what would become arguably the most influential English Bible of all time.
The KJV.
The KJV.
Yeah.
The King James Version.
It's still so well known today.
It is.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.
What's the story behind that one?
So the KJV, it was commissioned in 1604.
Okay.
And published in 1611.
Okay.
It was the product of the work of about 54 translators.
54 translators.
Yeah.
Wow.
Although the names of only 47 of them have actually been recorded.
Interesting.
Yeah. And much like, you know, new translations today.
Right.
The KJV faced some controversy.
Interesting.
When it was first released.
You'd think it'd be like universally loved.
You'd think so, right?
Yeah.
But people were resistant to change even back then.
Wow.
Yeah. But despite that.
Okay.
It went on to have
a
huge and lasting impact.
Yeah.
Not just on the English language,
right,
but on the whole English-speaking world.
That's amazing.
It is.
And Dr. Metters pointed out this fascinating detail about the KJV's source texts.
Oh, yeah. This is interesting.
Okay.
So the KJV was primarily based on the Greek text.
Right.
Compiled by Erasmus.
Erasmus, okay.
Yeah, and what's remarkable is that Erasmus's text relied on a really small number of Greek manuscripts.
How many are we talking?
Less than a dozen.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And even more surprising, Erasmus didn't even have a complete Greek text of the Book of Revelation.
Oh.
So he actually had to translate a significant portion of it back into Greek.
Back into Greek from...
In the Latin Vulgate.
Wow. So they translated it from Greek to Latin and then back into Greek.
Exactly.
Wow. That's wild.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to keep that in mind when you compare the KJV with more modern translations and have access to way more older manuscripts.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So that's not even the end of the story, right?
No. No.
The KJV went through revisions. Leading to later versions.
Right.
Like the Revised Standard Version.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So as Dr. Metters explained, they discovered thousands more ancient Greek manuscripts.
Wow.
Like over 5,000?
Right.
Compared to just the handful available to the KJV translators.
Wow. That's a big difference.
It is. Okay. And this gave them a strong motivation to revise and update those English translations.
Right. So they realized, hey, we have more information now. We can refine this.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And also, you know, scholarship advances.
Right.
And their understanding of the ancient languages had also improved.
So it was kind of a perfect storm.
Exactly.
Of like new information and better tools to work with.
Exactly.
Okay. So we've journeyed through this fascinating history of Bible translation.
Right.
And we arrive at this just huge number of modern English translations.
Yeah.
How do we even begin to do?
That's the question, right?
Yeah, like how do we make sense of this? Dr. Metters introduced two main approaches to translation.
He did.
Right.
Right.
So tell me about those.
Okay, so to understand the differences that you see in modern English Bibles, it's really important to get these two concepts.
Okay.
Formal equivalence.
Formal equivalence.
And dynamic or functional equivalence.
Okay.
So formal equivalence is often described as more word-for-word approach.
Word-for-word.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it basically aims to stay as close as possible to the grammatical structure and the specific words used in the original Hebrew and Greek texts.
So if it says love in Greek, it's going to say love in English.
Right. As much as possible.
Okay.
Now, obviously, there are limitations.
Of course.
But that's the general idea.
Okay. So examples of formal equivalence translations.
Yeah.
would include, like, the KJV.
The KJV, for sure.
Right, and then some of the versions that came after it.
Exactly. So Dr. Metters listed several examples.
Okay.
The ASV.
The ASV.
American Standard Version.
American Standard Version.
Then there's the NASB.
NASB.
New American Standard Bible.
Okay.
You've got the RSV.
RSV.
Revised Standard Version.
Revised Standard Version.
And the NRSV. Okay. New Revised Standard Version.
Okay.
And the ESV.
ESV.
English Standard Version.
Got it.
He also mentioned the Tanakh.
Tanakh?
Yeah, which is a Jewish translation of the Hebrew Bible into English.
Hmm.
And he pointed out that these formal equivalence translations largely fall within what he called the King James stream.
The King James stream.
Which basically means there are often revisions that try to improve accuracy and clarity while still maintaining
that close connection to the form of the original text.
So they're trying to stay true to the original as much as possible.
Exactly.
Okay.
And you know, when you're reading 1 Corinthians and you come across a passage, that seems difficult or has like multiple interpretations.
Yeah.
Like Paul's views on marriage or spiritual gifts.
Right. Those can be tricky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really helpful to look at how a formal translation renders the Greek. Compared to a dynamic one.
Right. Because you might find subtle differences in the wording or structure.
Exactly.
That give you more insight into the nuances of the original meaning.
Right.
Okay. So that's something to keep in mind.
Absolutely.
As we're going through 1 Corinthians.
Yeah.
We should look at different translations.
Right.
And see how they handle these tricky passages.
Absolutely.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And you mentioned Dr. Metters made an observation about the reading level of these translations.
Yeah, this is interesting.
Okay.
So the original King James Version was written at around a 12th grade reading level.
12th grade?
Yeah.
Wow.
But some more recent translations aim for like much lower reading levels to make it more accessible to a wider audience.
So more people can understand it.
Exactly.
Okay.
And he even shared the story about a friend in a tradition that really values the KJV.
Cool.
And this friend was struggling to help children understand its language.
Right, because it's written at such a high level.
Exactly.
So it's like this tension between the historical significance of a translation.
Okay.
And the practical need
for
people to actually understand it.
Right. It's got to be readable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what about that?
Guarding principle that Dr. Metters talked about.
Okay.
That Bruce Metzger came up with.
Yeah.
Regarding formal equivalence.
So Metzger's famous principle was to translate as literally as possible, as free as necessary.
Like, literally as possible, as free as necessary.
Yeah. And Dr. Metters emphasized that. But a truly literal translation isn't really achievable.
Why is that?
Well, because Greek and English are so different, especially in things like word order.
Okay.
Like Greek word order often emphasizes different parts of a sentence than English does.
Okay.
So a formal translation might try to keep that order even if it sounds a bit weird in English.
Right.
And that means that even formal equivalence translations have to make interpretive choices to create readable English.
So there's always going to be some interpretation involved.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not as simple as just plugging words in.
No, it's not a simple word swap.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's formal equivalence.
Right.
Now, the other main category is dynamic.
Dynamic.
Functional equivalence.
Right.
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 And that's often described as a thought for thought approach.
Thought for thought. Yeah.
Yeah.
So here, the translators are really focused on conveying the meaning and intent of the original in a way that feels natural to modern English readers, even if that means moving away from that strict word for word.
Right. So it's more about like capturing the essence.
Yeah. The essence of
The meaning.
Exactly.
Okay. Right. And the main examples of this that Dr. Metters gave were the NIV and the NLT.
That's right.
Right.
The New International Version.
New International Version.
And the New Living Translation.
Oh,
those are key examples.
And he pointed to the NLT's introduction as a good explanation of the principles behind dynamic equivalence.
And that was written by or had a lot of input from the scholar.
Yeah.
Tremper Longman.
Tremper Longman.
Yeah. He's a well-known scholar.
Okay.
And the NLT itself